The start of the week and plenty on the radio. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
I want the law to be done, justice to be done, at least, because it could have been your child, it could have been my child, and it could have been anybody's child. And as for God's sake, he could have left her dead there. She could have been dead, and that person just still fled the scene.
It's a hard one to talk about parties because, you know, you can't ask somebody, what are your darkest memories and would you delete them if you could? Like, it could get a bit grim.
The history of us and getting a tan. Go on. What's your understanding of it?
Well, you've Coco Chanel to blame for it, because up until the late 1800s, early 1900s, it wasn't considered fashionable at all to have a tan.
And we'll start in the afternoon on Liveline with Katie Hannan and a call from the bedside of young Sophia in Crumlin Children's Hospital by her dad, Daniel.
Daniel, you're, I understand, in Crumlin Children's Hospital at the moment.
Yes.
You're at your daughter's bedside.
Yep, indeed, yes.
Before we go into, what's your daughter's name, Daniel?
My daughter's name is Sophia.
Sophia.
Yeah.
Okay, well, take us back to what landed you in this situation, Daniel. Take us back to Saturday the 7th of May, and you're at home in your home in Blanchardstown.
Yes, in Cordo, yeah.
Okay, and of course, you're not originally from Blanchardstown, I'd say, with that accent, Daniel?
No, originally I'm from Romania, and I live in this country from 2002.
Okay, so you've been here a long time.
A long time, yes, indeed, yeah.
And you're settled in, you're living in Blanchardstown. So, yeah, take us back. Saturday, is it the afternoon?
Yes, Saturday it happened in around between 7 and 8 o'clock p.m. My daughter and my kids, they were inside, and my young daughter, Sophia, she was inside. All my other kids started going outside to play with their friends. And then a few kids from the neighbours, they came to my house and said, can you bring Sophia out? Will you let her out for us to play with her half an hour? And I didn't know, because my neighbours, I'm a long time there. I'm very known to my neighbours there in Cordoff. So I was just thinking, okay, I'll let my daughter outside to play. Then after exactly, I'd say, 10 minutes roughly, all I hear outside is just some screaming, kids screaming and neighbours screaming. So I never thought of anything that happened. When I go outside, just to see what's happening, all the neighbours are starting shouting behind the car. There was a blue Jeep, a Q7. I didn't have a look at the reg, which my two neighbours there in Cordo, they have cameras in the front of their houses and on the main street as well. So I don't know if their cameras caught the reg number, but they said that it was a blue Q7, and I seen it myself. It was a blue Q7, a Jeep. So when I heard the noises, I start going outside. Next thing I see, my young son is keeping her in his arms, and my daughter was crying. So I just seen a scratch on the head. I seen a scratch on the little mouth. I thought she fell. Then the neighbours come directly to me and says, look, that Jeep over there, tell him to stop, that the person. I says, why, what's happening? And then they said, look, that little baby legs, he just started rolling over her legs. I was like, no way. I was in a shock. I didn't know what to do. And then I seen my daughter as well. I spotted her in the arms of my son, and I just started screaming because I didn't know what happened. I didn't know what was going on at that moment. So I started chasing the car for like about 7 seconds, 5, 6 to 7 seconds. I couldn't have a look at the reg right. I didn't take his reg because I wasn't thinking nothing, just to run after the car, because the neighbours as well were telling me he's just after running over her legs.
And did you see, was it a man or a woman? Could you see it was a man behind the wheel?
I couldn't see. I think it was a man. Definitely it was a man. I know it was a man behind the wheel. It wasn't a woman. Definitely for 100% sure. Okay. It was a man that was driving that car. That Jeep.
So you went back to Sophia?
Yeah, I went back to Sophia there. All the neighbours started gathering around. All the kids started crying because they just got paranoid there. They couldn't believe what they're seeing in front of them. The leg was a bit twisted, so she has blood coming out of the leg. And I didn't know what to do. I was just telling the neighbours, please ring me an ambulance, ring an ambulance. And I was just holding her myself there. So I was just in a shock. I didn't know what to do, how to react, what to say. My wife, She's pregnant, as I told you before. She's pregnant. She had to give birth. She had to go another month. But because of the stress and all everything, she was at the hospital. At this moment, as I'm speaking now, I'm at the hospital here at my daughter because my wife was here with her. And the ambulance from Crumlin here brought her to the Rotunda Hospital. And she's going to give birth to another child there.
Oh, she went into labour.
Yeah, she went into labour, basically, which she had another month ago. But instead, they put her in quicker, beforehand, before labouring day.
You think because of the stress of what's happened, yes. Sophia?
And I want to say this, please. If my neighbours here, if they're hearing this from Cordoff, where I live in Blanchardstown there, and if the police are hearing this as well, I want the law to be done, justice to be done at least, because it could have been your child, it could have been my child, and it could have been anybody's child. And as for God's sake, he could have left her dead there. She could have been dead, and that person just still fled the scene. He left the scene. He didn't stay there. The neighbors were shouting behind him. I was shouting. I run, as I said, 5, 6, 7 seconds. I run, chase the car down. And at the traffic lights, I know there's cameras as well. As I said, my neighbours had cameras as well. And hopefully the guards in Blanchardstown are doing all their best, which I think they are, to catch the person that fled the scene.
And Katie asked Daniel about Sophia's injuries.
Her injuries, to be honest, the hospital is telling me they still cannot proceed for an operation, but she is ready whatsoever for an operation they want to do. But at the moment, they're just keeping an eye on the wound. They said it's starting to heal kind of a bit, but it's not majorish healing, if you get me. It's still in the wound there because she's only a child and it's only a small leg there she has, and it's very hard for her to get it back on the go there. And she's still ready for an operation, and it doesn't really look good, to be honest, that good. I can let you speak with the doctor or anything and they'll tell you the truth. And I'm still in a shock myself. My wife's still kind of in a shock, especially my daughter. She wakes up, she just says, "Car, car, car." And I'm just there beside her. I'm crying. I don't know what to say. And I'm not just saying this for everybody to hear and to feel sorry for me. I know what I'm going through is it's only a parent will feel that pain. And I hopefully hope that and think that person will get caught eventually, because he could do it again, or he could have been anybody's child, and he could have been gone, the same thing. And you say
from how you describe that, Daniel, it doesn't sound like he couldn't not have known, because even if he didn't realise it as it happened, there was all the roaring and neighbours and the commotion afterwards.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say, is where I'm coming from is I wouldn't have blamed him, as I said, but I have to blame him because he left the scene. If he would have stayed there and he would have called the guards where they came or ambulance where they came and then get it dealt with, I could say, as I'm saying it now, it could have not been his fault. He could have done it without him knowing. But as you said there, it is his fault. And it has to be his fault because he left the scene, and that means he knew he hit my daughter there. And my daughter has a little two teeth in the front as well. There's a piece is missing as well from the tooth. And the leg, I don't know what to say. I think it's forever she's going to have that problem there whatsoever. But she's still young. Hopefully, and please God, her bones will grow back up, and it's only fractured, basically.
And do you believe that the car actually went over Sophia's leg?
I believe so, because a car would only do that leg like that, and there's actually a whole thing missing, her meat in front of the leg there. It's like a piece missing there. You could see in the inside, if you get me, the bones. I don't know how to tell you. You could see the flesh in there. Oh my God, it's shock. It's unbelievable. And please, I'm appealing again, all my neighbours in the Cordoof, whatsoever, with any information about that car, or if any information they know that person, because I believe that person lives on that street. He lives on my street there, and I don't know, I cannot do anything on my own, but with the help of the neighbours or anybody with any information, a blue Q7, I couldn't say the reg, but it kind of looked like it's a new car-ish kind of a new car. with any information, I'd be more than happy, because, as I said, he could do it to anyone else and he could do it the same and he could just run away. And I feel sorry for what happened to me, and I'm still in shock. I can't believe it.
That's Daniel on the live line with Katie Hannon. And on Today with Claire Byrne, Senator Eugene Murphy was talking about the problems he's having finding a hotel room in Dublin.
There are reports this morning about a politician who had to resort to sleeping in the car because there was no accommodation available for politicians. Now, that person in that piece is not you, but you've had to resort to that on two occasions yourself. Is that right?
That's correct, Claire. I can certainly identify with the story in the Mail today, and particularly over the last month, 6 weeks, it has been extremely difficult to get a room anywhere in the Dublin region. Just to put that into context, I was successful in getting a room one night in the last three, and in the hotel I booked, I tried to book forward for this week and next week, and they told me there was not a chance of getting a room.
Okay.
So it is a difficulty at the moment, but I can sit there. I don't want to be whinging about this, because there are people in far greater difficulty out there in relation to housing. This is a matter we can get over, but it definitely is happening at the moment.
So one night in the last three. So I take it then this was a very recent situation that you faced, Eugene.
One night in the last 3 weeks. Yes, one night in the last 3 weeks. So it is something that never arose before. I'm almost 7 years in the Oireachtas between the Dáil and the Seanad. And this matter, Claire, never arose before. So it is a difficulty. And I know that a number of TDs from the rural areas and some senators seem to be affected by this as well.
Mm-hmm. Some would say, well, why don't you just drive home? Will you just explain to me what time you were finishing work?
Well, some, you know, particularly if you have a parliamentary party or if the Seanad runs late, I mean, I wouldn't get out of there before 10. Now, I'd be looking to get home in 2 hours plus, so maybe 12, shortly after 12. You get to bed around 1, and basically I would have to be up at 4 to try and beat the traffic in the morning. You have to get in before 7:30 through the city. So it's just, you know, it's difficult and it's tough. You end up, in my situation, with probably 3.5 hours sleep per night, and you definitely find on the next day that you're just not able to function as you should because of lack of sleep.
Yeah. Yeah, but you'll probably feel the same way having slept in the car. And anyone who's tried to have a rest in a car knows that it is uncomfortable. It gets cold. You don't feel particularly safe, I'm sure. I mean, what was it like?
It was very difficult. And that's when I hear of anybody out there who has to sleep in the car because of housing difficulties. It always, you know, strikes me as something absolutely appalling. But I would have got halfway down the country. I would pull in at a forecourt. You mentioned security there. At least you have the lights and you have people knocking around. So usually around Mullingarry, I would pull in at a forecourt and sleep there. And just at around 5:30 in the morning, wake up, head for Dublin. I mean, you would try and shave and have a change of clothes when you got to your office, get a bit of breakfast. But I can assure you that you don't certainly feel good in the morning after such an event. And you're right, even taking a nap in a car for a few hours and you wake up, it's not a great feeling.
So have you done that very often then? Like more than the two times you've told us about?
No, I mean, sometimes, particularly when I was a member of Dáil Éireann, Clare, on numerous occasions I would have taken a nap for an hour on the way down.
That's just to break the journey, though, is it?
Just to break the journey. But even after that, you don't feel great, you know.
Yeah. But this is different because, I mean, we should explain to people that you're a senator, you're on a good salary, a decent salary. You also get this overnight rate of €120 to stay in a hotel. But you're saying you couldn't find anywhere. Could you find anywhere for even above the 120?
Well, on a point of principle, I wouldn't actually pay over 200 for a hotel. So to be honest with you, I wouldn't have tried the more expensive hotels. No, I wouldn't.
Okay, so once it goes to over 200, you say I'm out, I'm not paying that.
Absolutely. But I think one interesting point about all of this, Claire, you know, I would engage with people in the hotels and I find that, you know, it's not all Ukrainians that are in the hotels. There seems to be a lot of business people, tourists around at the moment, some Ukrainians, but it's certainly not in every hotel situation where Ukrainians have fully taken over. They haven't.
Do politicians not usually have a deal with the hotel? You know, the one that you'd normally stay at and you might have a booking for the Tuesday or the Thursday night that rolls over and you take it up as you need it?
No, that seems to have gone out the window.
And you've tried to do that. You've told us tried that.
Yes, and I know others as well. It's gone out the window completely. And the prices have risen as well. But as you said, we have that organised allowance. We're very, very, very lucky to have that. But certainly the rollover situation seems to be gone in certainly in the hotels that I used to deal with.
So the two occasions then that you did sleep in the car, were you in your car inside the gates of Leinster House?
No, I didn't ever sleep inside the gates of Leinster House. But I know somebody that did on one occasion. I did think about sleeping in my office one time, but I felt, you know, that that wouldn't be probably a proper thing to do. So you just get into your car in your head when you can't get to a hotel. And if you get home, you get home. And if you're just too tired, you just, as I've done on two occasions, pulled in at Mullingar, off the bypass, at a filling station. And you just sleep it out for a few hours and that's it.
Senator Eugene Murphy from Today with Claire Byrne. Now, a novel with a compelling plotline that makes you question everything. Tell Me an Ending is the new book by Jo Harkin, and it centres on the concept of erasing a memory and its potential outcome. Jo was Ryan Tuberty's guest in the morning.
Imagine receiving an email informing you that you have had a memory deleted. With no memory and no knowledge of what it is or why you chose to remove it, you're given the option to have it restored. What would you do? Would you do it? Chance it? Or just let sleeping dogs lie? This is just one of the many what-if questions raised in the new novel, Tell Me an Ending. It's written by Jo Harkin. I enjoyed it tremendously, which is why I wanted to bring her on the show and say hello. Jo, good morning to you.
Hi, good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
No, congratulations on your book. It's a terrific read and had me curious from the very, very, very beginning because I find it quite hard to explain this to people. If I say to somebody, I've just read a really good book, it's kind of science fiction. Half the people I talk to are saying, no, I'm gone. And I'm going, well, it's not Dune. You know, hang on a second. You know, some people have just this thing about science fiction.
Yes, I think there are a lot of preconceptions with it, which I think is why sometimes writers say they write speculative fiction, because I think with sci-fi, there's this assumption that it's like aliens or robots, or zombies or something. And actually, it can be very close to real life, which I think shows like Black Mirror have actually made it a lot easier to explain this kind of sci-fi, because, you know, everyone loves it. And you can explain it's like our lives, but with one sort of tweak, like one what if question, as you described it so well just now.
Speculative fiction, I think, is a great expression or term to describe it rather than science fiction. So let's focus on that for a moment. Can we get the nutshell shape of the book, Jo, if you don't mind, just to start us off?
Oh, of course. So basically, it follows several different characters. They all find out they've had a memory removed and they're basically struggling with the dilemma of whether they want it back or not. And then you also have Noor. She's a psychologist at the memory clinic itself. And she's beginning to wonder if everything there is above board, particularly with reference to her boss, Louise, who she's been watching and is beginning to question.
OK, and with that in mind, you mentioned and referenced a couple of times in it, the film. I don't even know, it's like it was a book once, but Eternal Sunshine of a Spotless Mind.
Yes.
Why did you do that so knowingly?
Well, I mean, I think it needed acknowledging because, I mean, it's an incredible film. I love that film, even though some of the characters in the book kind of take the science apart a bit. Mm. It's not really a film about science. It's a film about memory and love. And, you know, those are the themes of my book also. So I kind of wanted to address it. And because my book is set in the real world, like these characters would know Eternal Sunshine. It's one of their references. So I did enjoy putting that in there, as well as all the other, you know, the cultural references, the philosophy, the science. Like that's, aside from the clinic itself, that's all real world stuff as well. And yeah, that was important to me to have that in there.
Yeah, philosophy comes into a lot. Existentialism, if you like, to be too highfalutin about it. But let's face it, you're reading it going, God, if I could erase that moment in my life, wouldn't that be a great thing? And then you have to stop and say, but what about the tapestry, broadly speaking, of the dominoes that fell as a result of that moment you're trying to get rid of? You nearly had to put the book down and go, okay, hang on, I have to deal with the enormity of this thought for a second. Is this where you were coming from in the great what ifs?
Yeah, and I love that. Like, I mean, I'm really annoying when I watch a show like this on TV. I'm the one who's pausing it to start a debate or kind of more realistically a monologue about what I would do in that situation. Would I do it? Would I not? And yeah, I kind of wanted my book to tap into that same, you know, personal experience. Like, you put yourself in the shoes of these characters. And I think, yeah, it's an interesting one. It's a hard one to talk about at parties because, you know, you can't ask somebody, what are your darkest memories and would you delete them if you could? Like, it could get a bit grim. But it is a fun one to think about, definitely.
I think that's the kind of party you want to go to, actually.
Yeah, after a couple of glasses of wine, I mean, yeah. Yeah,
that's what I'm talking about. Rather than go, how are the kids? Great. Now, what's your darkest memory? Why do you want to get rid of it? Much more interesting, Joe, don't you think?
Absolutely.
And Trekkie Ryan had to ask Joe about the reference to Star Trek.
Your mother, as a Star Trek fan, which you aren't necessarily a self-professed fan of, comes to mind because you do reference one episode in which William Shatner's Captain Kirk falls in love with an android of sorts. And so he falls so hard that when she malfunctions, stay with us, it is Star Trek, he is heartbroken beyond repair in some respects. What happens next?
Well, so yeah, this is, I wasn't a Star Trek fan growing up because I was very easily frightened as a small child. Yeah. So my mum used to like it and I remember it being on and I would always stay out of the sitting room when it was on. But yeah, in this episode, basically, yeah, Kirk falls in love with the robot, loses her, and Spock decides that the best thing for him is to delete his memory using a Vulcan technique. So Kirk wakes up the next day and it's as if it never happened, which obviously in the book taps into the themes of, do these memories change you as a person? And one of the things that one of the characters thinks about in relation to this is he may not have the memory of having fallen in love, but the love itself may have changed him on a level. Mm. Yeah, because it functions as a different kind of memory, really.
Yes, but it does scramble my brain to think about that.
Exactly. And I mean, this is Eternal Sunshine as well. Like, he may not remember that he's been in love, but the love has changed him and it's made his mark on him.
Right. And then you have to ask yourself, if you didn't have that terrible memory, how would you know how joyful a beautiful one is?
Well, this is true. I mean, with a PTSD memory, it's a little different, I think, because, you know, the technology in the book is originally developed to deal with PTSD. Yeah. And I think that's the kind of memory that the problem with those memories is they're not integrated into your experience and your development. They're actually more of an obstacle or a blockage. Like, you can't revisit that memory without being plunged back into the moment. It's intensely traumatic and it's you're stuck. So to deal with a memory like that and enable it to be kind of either processed or just removed, I don't think that really damages your development as a person. I think it's more of an aberration, a memory like that. So I think, you know, there is actually, I don't have shares in a tech company, by the way, but I think in certain circumstances, this tech could be a good thing.
You totally have shares in the tech company. You just had the memory deleted.
Yeah,
in the Nepenthe. Nepenthe is just getting an email after the show going, yeah, we need to talk to you kind of urgently. Okay, Nepenthe is the name of the company that provides this operation to get rid of the memory you don't want in your book. And I love the origin story for the name of that company because we are going back into the great epics of the ancients. Talk to me about that, please.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I wanted to show, I mean, memory removal has been a concept that's been around since fiction has been around. Mm. So obviously, you know, in the Odyssey, we've got Helen removing the memories of soldiers who fought in the Trojan War, mainly because she just wanted to have a nicer dinner party.
Can we back to the dinner parties again?
Yeah. So you don't want any awkwardness at the table. People she kind of started the Trojan War. So she wipes everyone's memories and they have a lovely night.
Right.
But yeah, so that's the origin of the phrase Nepenthe. It's Nepenthe's Pharmacon, and yeah, it's a potion that is given to people to make them forget.
Yes, and Edgar Allan Poe gives it a mention, doesn't he, in The Raven, as you say.
Yes, exactly. So yeah, this guy who's lost his lover is crying out for this potion, which obviously in the poem doesn't exist, but he wishes it did.
And Ryan asked Joe about sci-fi and the current sense of anxiety.
And you wrote this book just before, you completed it just before the pandemic. So this is not a sort of a reactionary book to our times in terms of the pandemic, but possibly in terms of life kind of since 2016 in the world where there has been a lot of bleakness. And, you know, this sort of global bleakness in history begets a particular type of literature, Joe.
Yes, yeah, I was in a chat with your producer. I was thinking about this. We were talking about how sci-fi tropes can really, you know, just function as a stand-in for real-life anxieties. And I was thinking about that since, and I think memory kind of in itself is the anxiety, which is why you see it in fiction since, you know, almost the dawn of human existence. It's been in sci-fi throughout the years from Philip K. Dick and so many other writers through to like Black Mirror and Severance and things now. And I think, yes, it sort of ties into, you know, the world is bleak and difficult. But, you know, the world's been bleak and difficult for a really long time.
Yes.
And so I think it is, memory itself is almost, it ties into, you know, memory is everything. It's, we don't experience the future. We experience the present for a second before it becomes memory. So all our perceptions of love, relationships, life, our identity, all of that's based on memory. So the idea of losing it is, that's its own anxiety, you know, which is why the idea of it is such a great thing for a fiction writer. Like, if you disrupt memory and destabilize it, you're destabilizing all these other areas of these poor people's lives as well. So it's kind of gold from a writing perspective.
Yes. If memory was a friend, you'd say he was very forgetful.
Yeah, exactly.
Memory is a very, very unreliable phenomenon. I know you did some research into this whole area of memory. I think we spoke on this program, actually, about the scientist Elizabeth Phelps and her survey of people who were around Twin Towers on the day of the attack.
Yes, yeah. So, yeah, she was one of the lead researchers on this study. And it was disturbing to read about. They surveyed people, I think, a couple of weeks after, a year later, and then 3 years later. And they asked them where they were when they heard about the towers falling, what they were feeling, and various other questions. And they basically found that after the towers happened, their memories were fairly accurate. Hmm. And then after a year, memories in general were only 63% accurate. So, and apparently emotional memory was the least accurate of all of those. It dropped to 40% accuracy after a year. And nobody knew that this was, the people themselves believed in their memories. Like, they thought the memory was reliable and this is what happened. It's only because the researchers were able to refer back to their previous answers that they could see how these memories were changing over time. Memory is not this fixed, uncorruptible packet of data. Like, it's a dynamic thing. The act of remembering, the conditions under which we remember things, change the memory itself. Yeah. It gets sort of altered or contaminated, if you want. We can obviously get worried about that or make our peace with it. Like, the book is very much like addressing these kind of concerns through, with a like tech spin on it.
Well, that's it. I mean, one of the characters in the book uses social media to kind of help retrace the steps of her deleted memory. And that brings into this conversation, particularly for that generation. You remember they used to say the revolution will be televised. Now the generation's life will be videoed and recorded. So, and yet you generally tend to record only the good stuff. So if you were to curate your social media, the chances are it's a totally skewed world of parties and joy and optimism and crack, as we'd say. Yeah, I don't know anyone who records a row.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, some people's social media, I think, is quite doom and gloom. But on the whole, we like to present this, as you say, idealized version of our lives. Mm-hmm. So, and it, in a sense, that could be a good thing. You know, you look back at your feed and you see all this string of just lovely times, and that will start to shape your memory.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe that's nice. Maybe, you know, we look back and the past seems lovely, and you know, if we delete things we don't like, you know, if a relationship ends, for example, you could delete the memories of that on Facebook because you don't want it to be part of your sort of record. And you're also doing the same thing in your brain, even though you don't realize it. Like, the brain will pull out the things that it deems most relevant to what you want to feel about yourself at that time, and it will prune the rest out. So you're actually doing this process of curation, like on your external hard drive, the social media, and internally in your brain. And you know, that's kind of how it goes.
Jo Harkin, the book is called Tell Me an Ending, from The Ryan Tubridy Show. And on Today with Claire Byrne, Fionn Davenport was talking about travel fantasy and travel fact and some of the hidden gems you actually might prefer to go to.
Venice, Barcelona, Amsterdam, all great cities to visit, but they have become victims of their own popularity, with throngs of tourists putting pressure on the ecosystems and the local way of life. And over-tourism is a phenomenon in popular cities and also beach resorts all over the world. So today we're going to do a tour of the alternatives to those places, and I'm joined in the studio by travel journalist Fionn Davenport. Fionn, we all know this. You know, we've all gone to those places and you have romantic notions about, say, Venice. Take Venice as an example. And it's just not fun to be there.
It really isn't. And also, as well as someone, I'm very conscious of the fact that I'm advising people not to go to one of the world's most beautiful cities, mm-hmm. this unique place. And I use the word unique because it very much is unique. And say, look, and it comes across as a bit spoilery. But the truth is, as you pointed out, you've got a city of roughly 500,000 people that gets 50,000 people that gets 20 million visitors a year. And so, as beautiful as Venice is, and I was lucky enough and reported on the programme to visit kind of in the break during lockdown, and I saw Venice devoid of what I can only liken to people emptying a football stadium. That's what it feels like to walk around Venice at ordinary times. And it's, the experience is dead. It kind of ruins the city and it ruins your experience of it. So you're paying high prices for what? Just to stand in big throngy crowds. So, and over-tourism is a real issue and the Venetians are very concerned about it. So I thought it best to look at alternatives.
And what's an alternative then? I mean, we're talking about Venice. Venice.
So just across the border, Slovenia. Ljubljana is one of the most beautiful capitals in Europe and gets relatively few visitors. It's stunningly gorgeous and it's not far from Venice. You can get a train from there. So as I said, Ljubljana, which is more Baroque architecture than anything, but it's got canals running through the middle of it. And there's also Brda, which is another city in Slovenia, which has more of a Venetian feel to it in that it would have been built roughly around the same time.
Okay, so there are two options then. Yeah. you would recommend.
And cheaper, by the way.
Well, see, it's all good. Cheaper, fewer people, you know, less angst getting around. And you know that you're not putting all of that pressure on their ecosystems because
exactly.
there's not as many people there. Now, sun and sand.
Yeah, so Thailand.
Yes.
So the Andaman coast and the Gulf of Thailand. You know, so obviously people go to Phuket and Koh Phi Phi and Koh Phangan and Koh Samui and these gorgeous, gorgeous islands. But again, the victims of their own popularity. So here is a real left field alternative, Mozambique. Now, one of the issues, and it is worth pointing out, is that access is key for people.
Yes.
You know, it's all well and good saying, oh, you should go to this place, but you have to take 19 flights and you have layovers, etc. Thailand is a two-stopper, no matter what way you cut it. So mm-hmm. you always have to either go through either the UK or parts of Europe or the Middle East. So Mozambique is a two-stopper again. And the beaches of Mozambique are as beautiful as the beaches of Thailand were 40, 50 years ago before they became this kind of hugely popular place to go.
Now we're telling everybody.
I know.
But
I mean, listen, we're a country of 5 million people. So I'm not that concerned that they're going to really suffer over tourism yet. But so you have Southern Africa. It's got that beautiful temperate climate. It's got 1,500 miles, that's over 2,000 kilometres of unspoiled coastline.
Oh, it sounds beautiful.
I mean, pristine white sand beaches with beautiful arching palm trees. The resorts are not nearly as developed as you would expect to find in Thailand, but that's fine.
That's fine, yeah, we can go
for that. Absolutely
fine.
And the place, so you can get two-stop flights. So you can go from the UK, you can go to Maputo or Vilanculos. And really, again, and much, much cheaper. Now, Thailand is still a very affordable destination. But having said that, Mozambique, I just think that places like Thailand, and we're going to talk more about other beach resorts in that part of the world, it's just they're oversaturated. And as beautiful as they are and as worth visiting as they are, it's just gotten to that point where the experience is not what you're paying for.
Because of the crowds?
Because of the crowds. And also they have huge problems with pollution. So, for example, you have a pristine section of sand where you have cheek by jowl, one hotel, two hotels, just hotel, discharging into the waterways, and they don't have a developed infrastructure to deal with that level of tourism.
Yeah,
the Philippines has suffered this problem horrifically in the last few years. Again, I'm conscious about, like, I'm not advising people not to go. I'm advising people think about these
things.
Have a think before
you
do.
Fionn Davenport from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the morning, a trip down memory lane. Rory Keane and Mick McCarthy and the 20th anniversary of the Saipan World Cup.
It was 20 years ago today in the northern Mariana island of Saipan on the eve of the World Cup finals when a dispute between Mick McCarthy and Republic of Ireland captain Roy Keane led to the player being sent home. It remains one of the most controversial moments in Irish sport, and on the anniversary of the infamous row which divided the country, our soccer correspondent Tony O'Donoghue, who was in Saipan, remembers the events of an extraordinary week.
Come back, Roy Keane.
It remains the most seismic rift in Irish sporting history, a trauma that still reverberates. Roy Keane sent home from Saipan before the tournament even began. World Cup warm-ups don't get more heated than this. Keane, frustrated by what he considered to be unprofessional preparation, had had enough and told manager Mick McCarthy he wanted to go home.
I spotted Roy after training and he'd been having concerns about his knee and some personal problems which are personal to him. And he has to go home.
Already this was remarkable, huge news in itself, but this story was about to spiral. Having spoken to his family, who were due to travel to the World Cup, and his Manchester United manager Alex Ferguson, Keane had a change of heart. Now he was staying, but not without having his say.
We come over here, we travel halfway across the world, and the training pitch is a disgrace. And somebody's got to hold a hand up and say, it's like training on a car park.
For this World Cup, do you think you're in the right frame of mind mentally physically?
Without a doubt. I have experience enough and mature enough to what happened the last few days. It's history now.
It was the early days of the internet, and it was Keane's Irish Times interview that was downloaded by McCarthy, who called a players' meeting asking Keane to explain himself. Never one to shirk a challenge, the Ireland captain didn't hold back.
I can't, will not tolerate not being spoken to like that, but the level of abuse that was thrown at me. So I have sent him home.
I've never witnessed that, anything like it in my life. And, you know, there is a line. You can't cross it. And unfortunately, Roy has crossed it.
Steve Staunton, the New Ireland captain, and Keane, the biggest news story in the world.
Ireland skipper Roy Keane has been sent home from the World Cup. This has been confirmed by manager Mick McCarthy at a news conference in Saipan within the past hour. Our sports editor Tony O'Donoghue was at that news conference and joins us now by phone from Saipan. Tony, can you tell us what's been happening there today?
The most dramatic events I can remember in Irish sports news, Eileen.
Roy, can you give us just one reaction being sent home from the World Cup?
With the country convulsed, the Irish squad left Saipan for Japan. Keane left alone to make his way off the island, he spoke to Steve Watson of BBC Northern Ireland.
Can you give us any insight into what happened last night?
No.
Can you even tell us how you're feeling at the moment?
I feel very good. Clear conscience.
In Izumo, FAI General Secretary Brendan Menton made it clear that in his view, there was no way back for Ireland's star player.
Football is a team game. It's a matter of, is one individual bigger than the team? I think generally the answer in football is no.
Back home, though, the calls to have him reinstated in the squad grew louder, while other voices claimed he should never be allowed wear the green shirt again.
2 hours after completing a marathon journey from the other side of the world, Roy Keane astonished the posse of media camped outside his home by bringing his dog for a walk in the Cheshire countryside.
Back in Manchester, RTE's Tommy Gorman secured an exclusive interview with Keane that was seen and heard around the world.
If you thought that they'd take you back, that the players wanted
to take me back.
Yeah.
What do you mean if they take me back?
If they thought that they'd love to have you in the team, that Mick McCarthy was prepared to bury the hatchet with you.
We'd have to see. We really would.
The call needs to come, doesn't it?
There's no chance of you ringing.
That morning in Japan, the Ireland players held a meeting before training and the media were told a statement would be issued. But in a tale of so many shambolic twists, neither the manager or the players would deliver it. Instead, the hammer blow to Keane's World Cup return was delivered in error by the FAI press officer, Brendan McKenna.
Regrettably, the manner of Roy's behaviour prior to his departure from Saipan and the comments attributed to him since have left the staff and players in no doubt that the interests of the squad are best served without Roy's presence.
It's been a horrific week, and I think it's taken its toll, because ourselves, the young lads, the staff, it's been very emotional.
Morale out there must be at an all-time low at this stage.
It's quite possibly the worst preparation any country has ever had for a World Cup finals.
Whether it's right, whether it's wrong, what anybody else feels in here, it has been dealt with, and it's not going to change now. And I'd like to think that you're going to support the 22 players. Whether you support me or not, irrelevant at this stage. Get behind them, guys. Let's see if we can do well in this World Cup. Support them.
Tony O'Donoghue's report for Morning Ireland. And on the Ray Darcy Show, HSE lead on dermatology Anne-Marie Tobin was talking about protecting skin in the summer months.
While skin cancer accounts for the majority of cancer cases in Ireland, it is largely avoidable. Noticing the early signs is of crucial importance to receiving the best treatment. May is Melanoma Awareness Month. Professor Anne-Marie Tobin is the clinical lead for dermatology in the HSE and joins me now with some advice on protecting your largest organ and staying sun smart. Good afternoon, Anne-Marie.
Good afternoon, Ray.
That's kids love that, don't they? What's the largest organ in your body?
Yeah,
skin.
Absolutely. yeah.
And we don't take care of it, do we? We're sort of negligent when it comes to our skin.
I think we're getting better, though. I think a lot of people who've young children are very conscious of protecting their skin and the sun. So it's trying to get that message through to other people and to other generations that Irish people in general are quite fair-skinned and we need to be careful in the sun.
The history of us and getting a tan. Go on. What's your understanding of it?
Well, you've Coco Chanel to blame for it, because up until the late 1800s, early 1900s, it wasn't considered fashionable at all to have a tan. In fact, it was associated with being an outdoor worker.
So
tans, you'd see ladies were, you know, using parasols to protect their skin from the sun. And Coco Chanel made tans fashionable, so she's responsible.
She's a lot to answer for, doesn't she? Yes.
She certainly does.
and seriously, it is the most common type of cancer in this country.
So the number of skin cancers every year outnumber all cancers when you add them up together. So there's over 14,000 skin cancers diagnosed every year. And that's probably not the most accurate figure. There's probably more, because the cancer registry, which actually very good data, and we're very lucky in having very good data in Ireland, records only one skin cancer, you know, for a patient. Uh-huh. But it often patient might have two or three.
Yes. And there are two different types of skin cancer.
So there's two different types of skin cancer. So melanoma is the one that most people probably are aware of, and that's the deadliest form of skin cancer. So that's coming up to being the third and fourth most common skin cancer in men and women. So our numbers are getting up there. So that's the one where it arises in two different ways. In half of cases, it arises from a mole changing. So people should know what to look out for in moles that change. And it's a simple rule. It's the A, B, C, D, E. So A is if a mole becomes asymmetrical.
Right.
B is if the border changes, so if it becomes sort of ragged outline. C is the colour, so if you get more than two colours in a mole. And then D is for diameter, so if a mole is getting bigger, or, you know, about 0.5, 0.6, but increasing in size.
Right.
And then E is evolution, so changing. So that's half of how melanoma arises. And then in about the other half, it arises in a new mole. So rather than a pre-existing mole, it's a new mole that arrives. You should be aware that you can get new moles, and it's perfectly normal to do so up until your mid-30s. So it's if you get a new mole and that it changes. So that's melanoma skin cancer. That's the most the deadliest type of skin cancer. So there's approximately 1,400 diagnosed every year in Ireland, but we'd have about 140 deaths from melanoma every year.
And if I never went out in the sun, is that one way of preventing it?
It'd have a bit of a miserable life.
I suppose what I'm asking is it preventable? Is it completely preventable?
By and large. So the biggest risk factor for developing a melanoma is sun exposure, but there are other risk factors, such as a family history. That's an important one. And then if you've already been diagnosed with a melanoma, you've had slightly increased risk of developing a second one.
Anne-Marie Tobin from The Ray Darcy Show. And on the live line, Joanne called Katie in the afternoon about her mother's heart operation.
My mum is in need of a double bypass and a valve replacement heart surgery. And she is on the list as urgent in the Mater Hospital since before Christmas.
What age is she?
She's 76.
Okay. Okay.
So she's on the list since before Christmas in the Mater Hospital. And in March this year, she had all the preoperative tests done. She was admitted, everything ready to go for the operation. And on the morning of the operation, she was told at 8 o'clock that it was cancelled and she had to go home, that the surgeon's car broke down.
Right. Do I understand, have I got it right, that it had already been put off because of COVID?
That's right. Apologies. Yes, that's right. So it had already been put off because of COVID.
That was before Christmas.
That was before Christmas. Exactly.
OK, so this is the second time now. She's everything. She's all, as you say, pre-op, yeah, test done, all ready to go. And literally within hours of being wheeled into theatre, she's told there's no surgeon to do it.
Within minutes of her going into
within
theatre.
Minutes.
She's due to go, within minutes of her going into theatre.
So stressful,
she called me at 7:30 that morning and 10 minutes later, the phone call back was, there's no surgery going ahead, Joanne. So that was cancelled and we brought her home. Mam's deteriorated since then. And so the procedure since then was that I would ring or email every Monday morning to see if there was a slot available for her. The surgery is only performed on a Friday, we were told. And if there was a slot available on the Friday, then we had to wait till the Thursday to see if a bed was available. So this has been going ongoing.
So have you been doing this every Monday since last March?
Yeah.
Every Monday you email to say, is there a slot available?
Yeah.
And have you had occasions where there was a slot available and then subsequently a bed wasn't available?
Yes, we have. Yes, we have. And I have gone wherever I could and spoke to whoever I could, trying to find out what I could do to have this done for Mam, because reminded that she is on their list as urgent. And we've been told that COVID has occupied, which I know though, but has occupied so many of the beds, that the cardiac team has lost so many of their beds on their wards, and that only emergency procedures were going ahead. So it transpired that last week. A Mam now, at this point, at least once a day, she almost loses consciousness to go to faint at home, along with all her other symptoms, pardon me, with pains in her arm, tightness in her chest, the inability to be able to do the daily tasks of anything, to looking after herself. And so we went to our GP, and our GP gave us a letter to go into A&E. So 4 days ago, we went into A&E, and after 2 days and one night in A&E, she got a bed on the Sacred Heart Ward in the Mater Hospital.
So was she? So she came in through A&E, having, as you say, had these episodes at home, and she still had to spend 2 days on a trolley and a night.
Yes, she did. And she's now currently in the Sacred Heart Ward and the Mater Hospital. So yesterday, her surgery was told that we was going to go ahead. So the surgeon came around on Saturday evening to say that she was going ahead in a Sunday surgery. Again, all the pre-ops got done, including the showers, everything that needed to be done. And Mam waited all day yesterday, fasting from 9 o'clock the night before, to be told at 2 o'clock that her surgery wasn't going ahead.
Why? Why yesterday?
Yesterday they said that there was a big case before Mam in the morning surgery and there was complications with that case. God love whoever that person is. And that's the reason why Mam wasn't going ahead then for the afternoon surgery. And since then, the nurses and all the staff are phenomenal and are so fantastic and lovely up there. But nobody has come to her. And I've spent the morning up there this morning to try and see somebody off the team. Nobody has come to her to say what's going to happen or what's not going to happen.
So she's still there. She's still a patient.
Yeah.
And is she afraid she might just be sent home again?
Exactly. She's afraid she might be just sent home again. And in March, when she was sent home in March, when I went to collect her the day of her surgery when it got cancelled, I said, I'm afraid to take Mam home because, I don't know you know, if she's, I don't want Mam to become just another statistic of someone who didn't make it in time to the hospital when this is all in place. And they actually gave me a letter to say that, yes, she is urgent, but she's clinically stable. And if she started to experience any new symptoms, to present herself to A&E.
Which she did.
Which she did.
And here you are now.
And here I am now. And, you know, I know the, I mean, my heart goes out for the caller you just had before me, and I hope that his daughter is going to recover and his whole family, and that person be brought to justice. And I know there's always somebody worse off than ourselves, but at the same time, my mum is important. And she is just being overlooked. And it's horrendous. And it's not only for my mum, although I want my mum to be looked after. It's for every mother in Ireland.
That's Joanne on the live line with Katie Hannan. And on Today with Claire Byrne, the problems facing families of children with a rare form of cystic fibrosis and access to a very specialised medication.
Because of a pricing dispute, some 35 children with a rare form of cystic fibrosis are unable currently to access life-changing drugs that have been approved for their age group by the European Medicines Agency. The drugs have been available to an older group here in Ireland, and there was an expectation that younger patients would have access to the medication once it received EMA approval. But a standoff between the drug makers and the government is leaving some families without this life-changing medication, and their children are waiting in limbo. Brian O'Connell has been looking at all of this for us and is with us now. So Brian, tell us the background here first.
Yes, good morning, Claire. The drug we're talking about here is Kaftiro. It's called Trikafta in the US, where it's produced by Boston-based company Vertex. And 35 children who we know would likely have a huge impact on their lives, they're currently not able to access this drug. Now, already in the region of 140 children with CF in Ireland who have a different genotype but are in the same age category, they are accessing the drug. The 35 children not able to get it have a particular genotype, and the standoff is whether or not they were included in a 10-year deal that was done between the HSE and the drug makers back in 2017.
Okay, and I know you got a response from the HSE on where things stand, which we'll come to in a moment, but you spoke to one family. They're pleading with the government to get them access to this drug.
Well, many people will remember the controversy and campaign around getting access to Orkambi, but this newer drug has been shown to be even more effective. And I suppose what's so frustrating for families, as you can imagine, is that fact. They know that it's going to have a huge impact. It's not cheap. Everyone recognises that, but the numbers are relatively small, so families can't see why a solution can't be found here. I spoke, for example, to Emma Fitzpatrick, and she told me about trying to get this drug for her son, James, who is 8.
We've always worked extremely hard to keep James healthy. The last 5 years with Kaftiro on the horizon, we've worked towards the goal that Kaftiro was coming. He does an hour of treatments before he goes to school in the morning. He does an hour every evening. But no matter what we do, even despite doing all that, CF is a progressive disease and nothing stops that progression in his body. Despite our best efforts, Kaftiro can stop it. And in fact, Kaftiro has been shown to reverse some of the effects. Now, obviously, the main part of that is getting it as quickly as possible into kids, as young as possible. We're not, the 35 are on nothing at all. There was nothing suitable until this stage, until Kaftiro was kind of coming along and on the horizon. This is our first drug. So this was our white horse on the horizon, our miracle drug coming down the line. So in January of this year, the EMA approval finally came through. Now, I suddenly know all these things about EMA approval and FDA approval that I never thought I'd know about. There were celebrations, like it was absolutely wonderful. We started doing all our kind of preliminary tests. So, and then suddenly out of the blue, we had a phone call saying no.
Can you explain the rationale behind that?
So the rationale, there was a pipeline deal that was done between Vertex and the HSE in 2017. So it was when Orkambi was the drug at the time that was being discussed. And at the time, this deal was done between the Vertex and HSE about the reimbursement for Orkambi and any future drugs that came down the line. Any kids that were on Orkambi would get future access to any drugs that were coming down the line as well. So at the time, we looked for clarification on that, and we were told that it was all clarified and no, it would be any kids that are persons that were eligible would get access to any drugs that were coming down the line and we were told that was fine. So the over 12s got access about 2 years ago, maybe 18 months ago, to this, to CAF Trio, and the over 12s that would be in the same category as the 35 kids with the different genotypes, they got access. It all went swimmingly. So, you know, everyone thought this is fine, this is all following the way it should. And then suddenly we were told, actually, someone seems to have realised there's a bit of a loophole there, and now it's all up in the air, and that we're not included in the reimbursement deal. It's all back on the table.
Emma speaking to Brian, and Brian also spoke to Philip Watts, CEO of Cystic Fibrosis Ireland.
You know, once the European Medicine Agency gives the green light, which they have, so they have said that the group of 35 children who have been affected, they will definitely benefit from this drug. Unfortunately, this genotype group cohort were not included in the 2017 agreement. So there is now a dispute over price.
So Brian, you mentioned there to Philip that you were onto the HSE and you were onto the Department of Health. What did they both say?
Well, quite a lengthy reply from the HSE on this, and they went into a lot of detail about their different engagements with the drug company on this issue. They say they're committed to providing access to as many medicines as possible from the resources available. They went on then to describe the criteria for assessing medicines. So, and they say that after this, the application for pricing and reimbursement of this group of 35 children, it remains under consideration with the HSE, but they can't make any additional comment on possible outcomes at the moment because it is an ongoing process at this time. Now, I wasn't able to get a confirmation as to whether or not the Minister for Health will meet with CF Ireland as a matter of urgency, which they are following up with today in an effort to try and get that meeting.
And in the meantime, families like the Fitzpatricks, they have to wait while all this goes on.
And as you heard, I mean, from Emma, they will have done everything they can to try and have their son James ready. But it's hugely frustrating for them now to have no certainty. They'd have no indication of when this drug may be available to them.
It's such a small number of kids. It would be very easy for them to fall through the cracks and just not be approved. And I suppose from our point of view, every day in our eyes that James doesn't get that drug is an unnecessary risk to his health.
And you will obviously have seen, because people have been on that drug in Ireland for 18 months, you'll have seen the impact it's made in their lives.
Yeah, massively. The CF community is very close in Ireland. So I have seen kids like transformed with this drug. It's absolutely unbelievable. It's far exceeding anyone's expectations.
That's Emma speaking to Brian O'Connell from Today with Claire Byrne. And that's it for Playback Daily. So mind yourself. Till next time.